the owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful sea green boat. They had some honey and plenty of money.
You see, I can't put my Adam Dog leash button.
Oh!
Wow.
Well, well, well. Isn't that great? Fancy keeping it all that time.
I have a small stash of Adam Dog leash buttons. I get out on special occasions. What's Adam Dog leash up to these days?
Well, as far as I know, he's investigating a very difficult crime in London at the moment, and I hope to write about it when he confides the details to me, which I hope he'll do this autumn.
Well, we could use him over here.
Yeah, it looks as if you could. He's not much of an expert on terrorism. That isn't his particular, but we've got a lot of experts on terrorism back here.
Well, he can learn.
Oh, he can learn.
It may not be a terrorist who set off that bomb. It may have been a disgruntled employee.
Would you think so with dynamite? Well, I suppose it could be.
But don't terrorists usually use plastique?
Yes, they use Semtex.
Yeah,
the IRA use Semtex.
Yeah.
Which is very difficult to detect because you don't need half a pound of it can do immense damage. It's just like putty.
Are you familiar with Stephen Vincent Benet?
No.
Stephen Vincent Benet was a poet, and his brother William Rose Benet was also a poet.
Yes.
And in his book of... he was very popular in the 1930s and 40s. He's not read too much anymore.
Mm.
But I photocopied this for you because there's a wonderful
poem that
he
wrote. Oh, that's very kind.
In the 1940s.
Yes.
Called Nightmare for Future Reference. And when you get to the...
Oh, I read that.
When you get to the last page of it, just look at the last line of the last page.
The last,
last page.
Oh, that's astonishing, isn't it?
So it's a whole poem about the fact that...
Isn't that astonishing?
Yes.
That's quite remarkable, isn't it?
So as I was reading Children of Men,
yes,
that poem came
back. How extraordinary. Thank you very much.
Yes, and it addresses almost exactly the same topic that you address in the Children of Men.
Isn't that astonishing? Thank you very much, Don. How thoughtful of you. I'm glad to have that.
It's been years since I read it. I photocopied it this morning. I should have reread it just to refresh my memory. But it is almost the same idea. And I think there are no solutions either to it.
In the poem, there aren't.
Except that it's an anti-war poem is what it
is. Yes. Well, I shall read that with very great interest.
Well, let's talk about the Children of Men. And this is certainly a departure for you, isn't it?
Yes, a complete departure. I didn't write this book because I felt that it was time I abandoned the mystery or progressed beyond the mystery. I don't feel like that about the mystery at all. I think that the mystery is a form that's capable of very high development, and I love working within it. But I got an idea which possessed me extraordinarily powerfully. I read in a newspaper about the dramatic and totally unexplained fall in the sperm count of Western Man. And interestingly enough, when I was coming here, I had the Times of London, the Saturday edition, and they had an article about it, which said that the fall is 50% in as many years. That is absolutely astonishing. And, of course, it's being studied by the Human Biology Department of the Medical Research Council back home and studied all over the world. And when I read this, I thought, well, I wonder what the world would be like if instead of happening fairly gradually, in 1 year, all over the world, not just Western Man, all over the world, the human race became infertile. No single baby could be born. 25 years after that, what kind of an England would we have? I suppose I did want to write a crime novel. I did want to write an exciting story, but that was going to be the setting. And when the idea came to me, I thought, well, you know, one day I'll write this book. And then I thought, Don, well, you know, you're 72, never mind about one day. If you want to write it now. So I wrote it. Very different indeed from my normal books, as you say. And different too technically, you know. In many, many ways it was something quite new and therefore a challenge, an interesting challenge.
What sort of reaction has there been to the book in England?
Well, on the whole, very good. But I think some critics have just either not understood it or been puzzled by it or worried by it. it is a very powerful novel. I know my English editor, when she read it, she was alone at her country cottage, and she phoned me up absolutely shaken and said she'd never been herself so possessed by a novel and so shaken by a novel. But I suppose there are some people who do love a mystery so much that they are longing for the return of Adam Dalgliesh. But most, I think, have felt that this is new and it's interesting, and they've been really very, very, very encouraging and very laudatory about it.
Well, the fact that you set the novel in the year 2021, actually, it's not necessarily a futuristic novel. You could have set the novel in 1921, because you don't deal with rocket ships and a lot of futuristic technology. That's not the point of the book, is it?
No, it isn't, John. I'm very glad you said that, and that's very perceptive of you, because I don't like it to be thought of as science fiction, because it isn't a very different world from the world we know. When Year Omega, the human race calls it Year Omega because it is going to be the end, after that year, there are very few scientific advances of any kind, because after all, scientists all over the world are directing all their energies to trying to cure the infertility. So they're not providing, you know, vast new airships or vast new machines or great developments. Medicine has developed, and the human race is very good at keeping people alive for a very long time. But otherwise, it's very much the world we know. And of course, the book is set in a city I know, which is Oxford. So that I don't feel it's an alien world in any way.
No, it's not. And it's essentially a story of a search, isn't it? It's a story of a search for fertile human beings to repropagate the Earth.
Well, it's very difficult to say what the theme is, because there are so many themes. And what has interested me about the book is the extraordinary variety of themes that people have seen in it. To some people, it's about power, and I think it is in some way about the exercise of power, because England has become a dictatorship ruled by this very charismatic dictator, Zan Lipiat. And it's about the temptations of power, and how far are you justified in being, as it were, somewhat of a tyrant, if you are able to keep society going and society reasonably peaceful. I think it's also about the growth of love. I suppose if it's got a message at all, it is that it's only if human beings learn to love each other that there is any personal salvation or any salvation for the world. Because the hero, if you can call him a hero, Theo Farron, begins by being so self-contained, selfish, failed son, failed husband, failed father, divorced, solitary, apart from the world, deliberately taking no interest. And because of his involvement with this little group of dissidents, and especially with the woman, Julian, gets drawn in. And by the end of the book, is a caring, loving human being. Although it's very ambiguous at the end. I mean, there's great hope at the end, but the ending is still ambiguous.
Is it possible for England, the great one of the world's great democracies, to be susceptible to a dictatorship by essentially five people, as you have in the book?
Well, I don't think it would be in the world as we know it at the moment. Undoubtedly, it wouldn't be. But, of course, it takes a great leap of the imagination, Don, to conceive of a world in which for 25 years, not for a short time, for 25 years, no baby has been born. So in the minds of everyone on Earth, the human race is dying out, absolutely dying out. So there's not much point in anybody working. I mean, when you consider it, much of what we do, even for people who haven't got children, depends on someone else coming after us. And those who have children and grandchildren, the houses we buy, the gardens we tend, the jobs we do, security for old age, it's all bound up in the idea that the human race goes on. And I had to make this great leap of the imagination and feel what would happen to them. And there is this great depression over the whole world, nothing seeming to be worthwhile. And then, of course, it's under conditions like that that a dictator can take over. And he gives the people what he thinks the people want. And what the people want is security. They want pleasure. Security before anything else. And then they want comfort. And then they want pleasure. And that's what he gives them.
Well, as you said, there are quite a number of themes in the book, and two of them, I think, are important to address. One is the, I think you call it the quietude, is that what you call it?
The quietus.
Quietus.
Yes.
Which involves older people who are in effect compelled to commit suicide. Now, tell me a little bit about that.
Yes. Because people want comfort and pleasure, because they see no future, they don't want to spend their time doing anything that's disagreeable. So they don't want to look after the old. They do if they love the old. But the old who have no one belonging to them, the old who have no one to love them, are rather subtly pressurized into committing suicide. And they have sort of mass suicides called the quietus, when white-robed, you know, they are towed out to sea and drowned. It's really very, very horrific. And although in practice this is all voluntary, of course we see in the book how it has ceased in a way to be voluntary, people are pressurized to do it. And I suppose one can see a world, you know, Don, one can see a world in which there is pressure on the old, not well, to take their pill after a certain age, you know, if they feel themselves to be a nuisance, to be a trouble, and that is what is happening in this world.
Of course, there is a growing suicide movement in this country, but of course, in your novel, these people could be perfectly healthy and still be vulnerable.
Well, they would be, but as long as they're able to look after themselves, you see, as long as they're not making any demands on society as a whole, I think they're just left. They're all right. But as soon as they really can't cope much on their own, then nobody else wants to cope with them, and there is this subtle pressure to take part in the quietus. The other thing, of course, that the dictator of England, the warden of England, Dalzan, is to banish all the violent criminals to an offshore island, the Isle of Man, which becomes a kind of penal colony.
That's not such a bad idea.
Well, you're thinking, you say that, Don. I tell you, the way we're feeling about crime back home at the moment, I think that this is the idea that Zan has that would commend itself to a very large number of people. We are really, at the moment, feeling very strongly indeed about crime. And, of course, in this world, people are not prepared to put up with it. You see, they've nothing to hope for, nothing to look forward to. So what they have in this world is everything, and they're not prepared to be frightened and have to sort of cower behind, you know, barricaded doors. They want freedom from fear. So anyone accused of a crime of violence, or anyone accused more than once of theft or burglary, is sent off to the Isle of Man, where, of course, they are given no protection, no help. They're all lumped together. What the Council of England say is to them, look, if this is the kind of world you want to live in, you go and live with others of your kind. And they're just given seeds to grow and water and left to it. And, of course, it becomes a little hellhole. But nobody is very much concerned about it.
Well, there was a movie some time ago addressing just that theme. And every criminal was sent to an island. Mm. Unfortunately, it was the island of Manhattan. All the criminals were sent to New York City. But there is a growing awareness and concern about crime in England. It has gotten much, much worse.
It has got a great deal worse, particularly with the young.
In the United States, we just kind of set the pattern for things.
It's yes, I mean, our murder rate, of course, compared with yours, is very, 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 very low. We tend always a bit to overestimate these things. I think our total 300 is at murders a year. The whole country, I think.
There are 2,500 in New York City alone.
I know, it can't compare. It really can't compare. But what is particularly worrying, crimes of violence and the young being out of control. And the general feeling is, you know, that there is no longer any respect for authority. The authority of the church has waned, of any religious organization has waned, whether it's Christian or any other kind. The authority of school teachers and the authority of parents has waned. That may be one reason. But we have a very large increase in juvenile offending. A lot of it, of course, is taking cars and driving them at great speed. I mean, I suppose, you know, this is a huge temptation to the young, but it's very irritating to their elders.
But you don't, now you live in London, you don't walk the streets with any sense of fear, do you?
No, I don't. But there are parts of London where I wouldn't walk the streets. Anybody, I think, living in a city is fairly streetwise. But I, on the whole, feel it's still a very safe city compared with some. No, I wouldn't. read, but I wouldn't go in certain parts of it after dark, for example. Although, you see, in the war, I would walk anywhere in London, even in the blackout, without fear. So there is certainly a huge increase in people's fear of walking the streets. And we've had, what I think has brought a lot of this concern about crime to the fore, has been a case you've probably heard of a two-year-old brutally murdered.
Certainly have. In fact, we had a number of telephone calls to CBS from people asking where they could contact that child's parents and where they could send donations and things. There's a lot of concern about it here.
Oh, yes. And, of course, what happened was the child was momentary. His mother just let go of him momentary when she was shopping in the supermarket. And the video cameras, the security cameras, showed a picture of the little boy very trustingly being led away by two other boys. You know, his hand in theirs. Well, I'm not saying, and can't, I mustn't say that they were responsible, because they haven't been tried, you know. I mean, they're entitled to the same security under the law as anybody else. But they have been arrested and identified.
How do you try a 10-year-old child?
Well, exactly. It will be before a judge and a jury, because they may plead guilty, I don't know. But there are special provisions in the law, but of course they can't go to prison. There's very little you can do to a 10-year-old child. Very little. And these children are only just of the age of criminal responsibility. I mean, back home, the age of criminal responsibility is 10. The law assumes that under 10, you can't commit a criminal offence because you don't know that what you are doing is wrong. It's 8 in Scotland. I mean, one can argue about that, but that's the law. So they're only just of the age of criminal responsibility. But the thought, you see, they not only brutally, whoever did it, not only brutally murdered the child, but put his body on the railway line so that it was run over by a train to make it look like an accident. Now, if that is true, there's a degree of evil there, isn't there? It's very frightening at any age.
One thing the United States has that accelerates the crime rate here are drug gangs.
Yes.
And almost inevitably these murders take place in drug neighborhoods.
Yes.
Among gang members.
Yes.
Drive-by shootings and things like
that. Yes.
Mass killings involving
yes.
drugs. Has that sort of epidemic, drug epidemic, reached England?
No, thank God it hasn't. No, it hasn't. But there are certain cities, and in parts of those cities, particularly again with the young, there is drug dealing on a fairly large scale, and some of these young are supposed to have guns. This is a new thing with us, because the gun laws are very stringent back home, of course. So, in theory, guns are extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get hold of. But these young people do get hold of them.
Sure, all they have to do is go to Virginia, state of Virginia.
Well, I don't
most
know
of the guns come from.
Despite their, yes, I think despite their lucrative dealings in drugs, Dom, I doubt whether they got the fare there and back to get it. But they get, you know, I think if the criminal underworld wants to get a weapon, it'll get a weapon.
Now, you mentioned that you deliberately left the ending of The Children of Men somewhat ambiguous.
Yes.
But I did have, but also with an optimistic note.
Very optimistic.
I don't want to spoil the ending for the listener who might read the book.
Mm.
But one thing did puzzle me a little bit, and after Zan and Theo have a shootout, in effect, it seemed to me that Theo was accepted by the remaining members of the council who accompanied him.
Yeah.
And I was a little puzzled by that, how he would be so accepted instead of being apprehended as a criminal and the killer of the Warden of England.
Well, of course, he'd been a member. He'd been advisor to the council for a time until he resigned, so they knew him. But I think it was because he had the supreme and very potent symbol of the ultimate authority. He had the coronation ring, which he took from the finger of Zan and held up. And one has to remember that there was no one else. You know, there's no point in killing. They were leaderless. They had no one else. And when he did that, of course, well, I can't, I mean, it's giving away the book, isn't it? But something else happens at that time.
Well, that's what
which means that he has, yes, exactly. He has control of something so important. But it isn't a bit surprising to me. I mean, he has the hope of the world in his possession, as well as the ring.
Did you enjoy this change of pace?
Well, it was odd. It was quite a traumatic book to write. It was this seems strange to say, but it was rather a given book, you know, as if somebody was writing it through me. It was so different, so powerful, that I'm left a bit puzzled by it and a bit disturbed by it myself, I think, in some ways.
But, of course, this book came out last year in England.
Yes, it did.
So you have been working on a new Dalgliesh for some time.
Well, plotting and planning, and very slowly it's going, John, I must say.
Are you plotting it now?
Yeah, just
you haven't
plotting
actually
it.
Started
oh, no,
to
no.
write it.
The plot hasn't solely come, it hasn't entirely come together yet.
Because you touch on a lot of current themes in your books, and you've involved Dalgliesh in some of these themes. What are some of the impetuses that give you ideas for Dalgliesh?
Well, with the detective stories, the mysteries, as you say here, they nearly always begin with a place. It's extraordinary how the place seems always to come first with a mystery. In the last one, Devices and Desires, this began when I visited the coast of eastern England and stood on a very lonely beach and looked out, you know, over the cold and dangerous and polluted North Sea and felt that I could have been in this spot and looking out over the sea and 1,000 years ago it would have been exactly the same, and then just turned my eyes to the north and there was the great stark outline of Sizewell nuclear power station, and I thought of the ruined abbeys I'd seen on that coast. They seemed like symbols, you know, of a decaying faith, and indeed the windmills, now made into rather prosperous holiday homes, used to provide the power, and the artifacts of my own generation, the pillboxes and the great clumps of concrete half embedded in the sand of the fortifications against the expected German invasion of the last war, and all the lives and centuries that had passed, and thought, well, right, this is where the new book's going to be set. It's going to be set in this part of England under the shadow of a nuclear power station, a community of people, some of them working in the power station, some of them living under its shadow. And I knew I'd got a new novel. It's after that, you know, that the people come, the characters come, and you decide who you're going to kill. Is it going to be somebody working at the power station? Why is she going to be killed? When? Where? How? What are the clues going to be? How am I going to get Dalgliesh down there? It's out of his patch, you know. He's a metropolitan police detective. And then last of all, you know, what the denouement's going to be. All that builds up over months, as it's building up with the new Dalgliesh now. It takes a long time. It's almost as if the story and the people exist in some limbo of my imagination, and I'm not making any of it up, really. I'm just getting in touch with them and getting it down on paper. And it's the same, it's exactly that same sensation and that same process I'm going through now. But that's how it works, and it's curious. It isn't often an original method of death that starts me off. It's a place.
Why don't you bring Dalgliesh to America?
Well, you see, Dominic, I couldn't bring him here as a policeman. I mean, I could bring him here as a visitor. I mean,
I was going to suggest. Now, you had a...
He could come, couldn't he, to a police conference here?
Well, no.
An international police conference.
I have a better idea.
Uh-huh.
You wouldn't
let's hear it.
That's too pat. But no. Didn't your daughter go to University of Colorado or Arizona?
No. Well, both daughters have lived here for a time. One lived here, 26 years ago. In Alabama, her husband was part of the sort of people working on the on space, and then my second daughter with her husband, they were in Oregon for 18 months.
I'm maybe thinking of someone else, but I thought that perhaps Dalgliesh might go to a writers' conference in a place like Arizona or Colorado. Or someplace you know.
Doing that, Don. He's terribly busy. What would you be doing going to a writer's conference?
Well,
I mean, he's a very good poet, but poets don't usually go to conferences. I think he's a rather lonely man, a self-sufficient man. I don't think he'd go to a writer's conference.
Some of his poems have been published. One in your last book, it was a bestseller, in fact.
Yeah, he could come over to promote it. You're so right.
Well, no.
He could do that.
But he would have fans here, his book.
Yes, he'd have fans here.
And he would be invited to come to a writer's conference.
Yes, he might be invited to give a talk, mightn't he, at some conference. But you see, suppose he did that.
A plot for your new
book. I know you are, Don. Very grateful I am, my dear. But the thing is, you see, all right, suppose he comes and there's a murder. He wouldn't be able to investigate it, you see. It's outside his patch. You can't see the American police saying to him, well, isn't it very lucky for us, Dalgliesh, you happen to be here. He wouldn't have any authority to investigate it at all.
Now, wait a minute. He would be a consultant, an advisor, because it would happen in a very small town where there where it's been 20 years before they had a murder, and the sheriff is not experienced in investigating homicides, and Outleash is called in as a consultant.
I can't see the sheriff calling him as a consultant. Well, I mean, it would show a fine international spirit on his part, but I think myself that's a little unlikely. He'd much more likely to say, it's just my rotten luck to have this limey on my patch. I don't suppose he'd call him a limey, that's strange. To have this Brit on my patch, no doubt thinking he can do this job better than I can. I feel that might be the reaction back home. I can't think if it were the other way around. An American here, I don't see News Corp saying, you know, jolly nicely got this very high-ranking USA detective here. He'll give us a hand. There might be a kind of comradely discussion about it, but I don't think he'd be able to do very much. But still, I mean, you know, it's a bright thought.
Well, I have a feeling I'm not going to be able to write your book for you.
Well, I'd have to pay you some royalties, I think, Don, if I did that, wouldn't I? Or at least dedicate it to you.
Just consider me a consultant.
Yes, I would do that.
Well, it's Children of Men. It's a futuristic novel, still a literary book by P.D. James. Wonderful book. Thank you very, very much.
Lovely to talk to you, Don. Thank you.